Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
You've got to keep up with Chris. Come on.
Ray.
He's got lovely
legs. Have you thought about getting longer legs?
I'm going to edit that out so it sounds like Chris is saying that to me. And I was like, oh, I really liked Chris Addison. I also, it was really nice to women. Imagine that's the trailer.
Oh, God, I've got to call the PR.
This week on Walking the Dog, Raymond and I headed over to beautiful Beckenham Palace Park in southeast London for a chat with the multi-talented comedian, actor, writer and director, Mr. Chris Addison. Now, Chris is very upfront about being a committed cat man, but I thought it was time he took a stroll down Dog Lane to see how he got on with my boy Raymond. Now, Chris has been a critically acclaimed stand-up for many years, but a lot of people first came across him via his brilliant performance on The Thick of It and his hilarious appearances on shows like Mock the Week and Would I Lie to You? But more recently, he's turned his hand to directing. He's won multiple awards for his work on HBO's Veep. He directed Rebel Wilson in The Hustle. And 2 years ago, he co-created the Sky show Breeders alongside the writer Simon Blackwell and the show's star Martin Freeman. Breeders is an incredibly funny, truthful take on modern parenting with really standout performances. And we chatted about the upcoming third series, which, by the way, you can catch on Sky Comedy and Now TV from Wednesday, July the 13th. Chris Addison is pretty much living proof that nice guys actually finish first. He's so well-loved in the industry, and you can see why. He's very curious and interested in other people. And yes, he's quick-witted and funny, just as you'd expect. But he's got this very benign, gentle energy. What I'm saying is he's basically a Star Wars mashup. Think the wisdom of Yoda, the charisma of Han Solo, and the adventurous spirit of Luke Skywalker. So naturally, he was very won over by my dog, Raymond. Yes, he lured him over to the dog side. How did he do that? Well, you'll just have to listen, won't you? I really enjoyed my walk with lovely Chris Addison, and I hope you do too. Do catch Breeders on Sky because it's brilliant. I'll hand over now to the man himself. Remember to rate, review and follow us. Here's Chris and Raymond.
He just doesn't know how to mark his scent. I've never seen a dog do this, so he's going to go, he'll see if he does it again. He'll go up to the thing and then lifts the leg that's furthest away from what he's trying to pee against. Oh no. My worry with this dog, it is a dog, right?
I mean, it's not getting off to the best dog, Chris Addison.
the vibe of this dog is like, it sort of reminds me slightly of, oh there you go. Oh. That's how to start a podcast, with a lovely turd.
He's had a bit of an incident. That's what I call it.
An incident. I'm impressed because the amount of hair I would be worrying about, you know, clagging.
I've forgotten the poo bag, so I'm using a wet
wipe. Oh, you've not got a poo bag? There must be. Wait, surely there's a...
Oh, there, Chris. Does this look...
That's
this
a recycling.
This is recycling and this is a general bin. Do you think that's...
I mean, well, I don't there want must to... be like a poo bin. Do you know, there is a dog shop there. We could ask
Should we ask the man? Yeah, but then do you think we'll have to buy something?
You could buy some poo bags.
Should we go there? Oh, that's a good idea.
It's yeah. Either that or you're walking around Beckenham Place Park with a turd in your hand. And, you know, which is one of the many reasons I don't have a dog.
Well, it's not the first time it's happened to me.
Yeah.
Plus.
Yeah, first time since you've had a dog, though.
The man's going to think I smell of poo. What's
no, he's that? Not, because you're going to go, I've got a dog. Let's ask him. He must have it. Hello, do you have any poo bags?
Yes.
You do? Where are they?
Yeah,
where are the poo bags?
Here. £1.50.
Oh, lovely. I'm so sorry, I've only got a card. Is that annoying?
Why? Do you know what, the guy? I'm just working here.
Oh. I'm doing some building work in here. Just ask me to quickly watch.
Wait, so you're having to watch the shop and he's not trained you?
He hasn't trained me. Oh, no, well, I've done it before. I think we might have some money, hang on. In coins, like in the
19th century.
I think we've got it. Yeah. It's really nice to meet you. Thanks for all your help with the poo bags.
No worries. Just got me away from working up there for a minute.
There you go.
Oh, thank you, Chris. Thank you, bye-bye. Come on, Chris, let's get our coffees. I like those men. They showed initiative. I like people that show initiative.
How can you actually watch a shop if you're not trained to operate the shop? It's literally just, maybe he just wants to stop people from stealing things. But it seems like an odd thing to ask somebody to do and then not back them up with the information that they require.
Let's get you a coffee. There's two setups here.
I don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
This looks coffee-ish.
Yeah, this looks coffee-ish. We'll get these. What would you like?
What would I like? I would like a decaf.
One of those.
Americano with milk. Yeah. No, it's not my choice. The doctor told me.
Hello. Can we have one decaf Americano?
What, with milk?
With milk?
With milk, yeah.
And can I have...
Is that hot milk? Sorry.
Oh, good Lord. However it comes. Cold milk is fine, yeah.
And I'll have an oat milk latte.
Aye.
Calf. Because that's how I roll. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Thanks.
He ran off, Chris.
How's the old obedience training going? He ran off. He sort of makes me think a little bit of... he's got a touch of... there'll be like cute little background creatures in Star Wars. Yeah. He's got, you sort of think, oh yeah, somebody's based a design on a dog.
Well, you're absolutely right, because George Lucas, apparently, I think he might have had a Brussels Griffin, and they're similar to these.
And that's where Chewbacca's from,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, but rather brilliantly, he's called an Imperial Shih Tzu.
No! I don't think I've ever seen a dog like Ray.
What do you mean?
No, I don't, that looks like that.
Well, you'll soon discover... He's got big dog energy as well.
Right.
Go to Chris. Where's Chris? There he is.
Oh, look at you. You're marvellous.
You see, we're going to talk about this, Chris. I know you're more of a cat man.
Very much so, yes. Oh, well, he's a charmer, isn't he?
He's very good for my ego because I get no attention at all. It's kind of like going out with a celebrity.
Do strangers strike up conversations with you? Right. That's why I can't have a dog. As it is, I walk around the world with a big pair of headphones on that basically say, please don't bother me.
Do you?
A little bit. I'm quite a friendly person, but I just,
Yeah.
That's yours. And we're going to put some milk in.
We're going to set off on our walk, which is very exciting.
Yeah. Nice part of the world, this.
Let's go, Chris.
Come on, Ray.
Let's follow Chris. This is his manor.
It's my manor, mate. No shitting on it. Because obviously he's a tiny weenie dog, but you say he's got big dog energy, so how far can he walk before he just goes, this is too much, what are you doing to me?
We've probably got about another 3 minutes.
But then I suppose he's so small you can just pick him up.
Oh, this way, yeah?
That really is like having a small child, isn't it? Because that's where you spend a lot of your time just lifting them up. He's absolutely intent on marking everything as his. Ray's Park. This is Ray's Park now.
Raymond, come on. Yay!
Does he have a pedigree name? Because I remember, one of my mates when I grew up had a fantastic Airedale, great big Airedale called Tandy, beautiful dog. But she wasn't really called Tandy because she's a pedigree. So there's a name that goes with that, which was Raj and Steve Snowsparkle. And you could make the dog whimper. And it seemed in embarrassment by going, Roger Steve. She would go, ooh, and look a bit sad. She really hated it.
We're in Beckenham Place Park, which is Chris Addison's manor.
Yeah, my neck of the woods, isn't it?
And I should formally introduce you.
Okay.
I'm so excited to have this fabulous man on. I'm with the very wonderful... I mean, it's going to take the entire podcast to list everything you do because you're such a polymath.
I've just been around for a long time, that's what that means.
He'll do that a lot as well. He's very self-deprecating, but I won't have it. Comedian, actor, writer, director, opera star.
I did also once work in a sandwich shop. Do you want to put that in? When I was about 18. Our Daily Bread, it was called. Like R for Roger and Daily Bread, like a double barrel surname.
Daily Thompson.
Yeah.
I'm with the very wonderful Chris Addison, and already this man has a fabulous energy.
That's nice to know, because I'm coming out the other side of a very bad hangover. So that's good.
Where were you last night? Are we allowed to know?
Yeah, it was strange. So just to put it in context, it's the perfect. The last night was the night that Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid resigned from Johnson's cabinet. And as it happened, I was going for dinner with Dara O'Brien and Hugh Dennis and Michael McKean in an extraordinary restaurant that was, get this, a Polish-Mexican restaurant. Yeah. So, like, you could get nachos with kielbasa on us. It was amazing. Wine, you know, there was wine with the meal, I seem to remember. I didn't feel terribly good this morning.
Oh, I love that. I love that you guys all hang out together.
Well, I haven't seen Hugh in like 10 years since I stopped doing Mock the Week.
Yeah.
But it was so nice to see him.
And obviously Michael's in your fabulous show Breeders,
which
we're going to be discussing quite a lot in this podcast because I'm a huge fan. But let's start with the animals question,
okay,
Chris. So we're with my dog, Raymond. You haven't got a dog.
I don't have a dog, no. I've never had a dog, actually.
Why not?
I was brought up with cats, also humans, not just... I wasn't left feral with cats, but we always had cats when I was a kid, and then so did my wife when she was younger. So we've just always had cats. And we've had our cat that we have now, if he makes it to next month, he'll be 20. So you know, the question hasn't really come up in the last 2 decades as to whether we would get a dog, because we've got this poor animal.
How lovely. And what's your cat called?
He's called Ernie. He had a sister called Erica Full, but she didn't make it as far as he did.
And did you have... You didn't have dogs growing up then?
No.
In the Addison household?
No, we didn't. We didn't. The only dog I ever met was Tandy, that dog my friend Matthew had. But no, never did that. I don't know why. I don't think dogs were as big a thing when we were kids as they are now. Everybody has a dog. And that, even before the pandemic, I mean, everyone got a dog over the pandemic, but everybody has a dog now. It's sort of extraordinary. And that wasn't the case before, I don't think.
I think you're right. I think it's interesting how I think dogs are seen as a sort of punctuation mark. They're like the full stop on the family now.
That's interesting.
But I think back then, certainly when we were growing up, they were a bit more friends with benefits back then. Whereas we put a ring on it now with dogs.
That's interesting. I mean, I remember my encounters with dogs were when I must have been 14 or 15, and I had like a paper round delivering the free local paper. Mm. And so my encounters with dogs were usually terrifying dogs in houses who did not like a cliche from a cartoon, who did not like the newspaper boy.
Yeah, and Alsatians as well, because they were huge in the 70s and 80s.
Massive. What happened to that?
The police took them all off the market. They used them all.
Mm. I love that to be true. Because, of course, you can breed more of them. That's the amazing thing about animals. You can create more stock. It's interesting what we'll allow dogs to do now. I think our attitude has completely changed towards them in lots of ways. I was always struck by a friend of mine who lives in Australia and grew up on a farm. Just can't stand the idea of dogs or cats in the house. It's a working animal. What's it doing in the house? Get it out there. And he, even though, you know, he lives in Melbourne now and has done for decades, he still has that sort of mentality. But we've really anthropomorphized dogs enormously in the last few years. I got into terrible trouble on guess where Twitter. You remember this? So I was in a Vietnamese restaurant, just having some tea, waiting for an appointment, and there's a couple with a dog in the restaurant. Now, I think, I'm, I don't think you should have a dog in the restaurant. I don't think that's a place for dogs to go. Lots of good places for dogs to go, but I'm not sure they should be in a restaurant. And people were vicious. Of course they should be in a restaurant. These people were feeding it off the table. And I was thinking, if I had a hamster in a cage and I brought it in and put it on the table, you 100% object to that, and you'd have every right to do so.
I want to know about the Addison childhood.
Right.
Because you grew up in...
I grew up in Manchester.
And you were in Wales originally,
yeah,
weren't you?
Yeah, I was born in Wales, but I was brought up in Manchester. I was born in Cardiff. My dad was a doctor, and he was working at the Heath Hospital at the time in Cardiff. And so that's where me and both of my siblings were born. But when I was very young, we moved to Manc.
And, oh, I love the sound of Dr. Addison.
He's marvellous.
Is he?
Yeah. Yeah.
And how many siblings do you have?
I have two. Yeah. I have two siblings, a sister and a brother.
And did your mum work, or was she a homemaker?
She worked doing lots of different things, actually. So she was, before we turned up, she was a teacher. And then she had a few years where she was dealing with, because he had, at one point, she had three. There's not a lot of distance between me and my siblings. So there's like, she had three under three at one point. And then wasn't working, because how do you deal with that? But then she went back and taught in a hospital for a bit, and then became a social worker, and then a counsellor, and then eventually, once we'd all gone, went back to doing what she really wanted to do, which was she went back and did a degree at Manchester University in English Language and Literature. 10 years later, she's another Dr. Addison. She did a PhD. She got a PhD when she was 70.
Oh yeah, because I remember seeing once, I thought it was really lovely when you were given an honorary...
Oh yeah, the degree graduation speech at Birmingham University.
It's really lovely, and I... Because it's such a brilliant speech. I love graduation speeches anyway, because they kind of generally make me cry.
Yeah.
But that really made me cry.
Oh wow. But yeah, that speech was just me. I basically emailed everybody I knew and said, what do you wish you'd known when you were... if you were sitting in the room with your cap and gown on and about to go into the outside world, what would you tell your 22-year-old self? And it was quite moving getting the responses from people, actually. And the biggest response, which is something that we've people on social media have started to become a bit snippy about, the biggest response from people was just be nice. It makes everything better. If you're nice, people want to work with you, people want to be with you, just be nice. And I reckon 70% of people sort of said some version of that in their responses.
It's such a lovely address you gave. It really was.
Oh, well,
so I'm imagining little Chris. I already love little Chris. I bet he was quite cute.
He had a fairly unruly head of, when I was very little, golden curls. It was very sort of, like a different era.
What was the sort of atmosphere in your family like? Was it, because with a doctor, I mean, I'm always so impressed by people that grow up in families like that, because I always think there must be quite a lot of structure and...
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think... I don't know, it's difficult to know how to answer that question, only because it's the only atmosphere that I've ever grown up in. But, you know, it was a regular family. Sometimes we got on, sometimes we didn't get on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you the attention seeker from a young age, do you
think?
Yeah,
I think so. And it's odd, because I'm the oldest, so traditionally it's the youngest, or even the middle. The middle is an awful place to be, because you're neither the youngest nor the oldest. You're sort of stuck in no man's land a little bit. But yeah, it's odd, because I turned out to be the performer in spite of being the oldest, which must mean that I am... So I wasn't trying to achieve something. You know, people becoming performers because they're the youngest, that's them trying to get attention from their parents. I wasn't trying to achieve that, I already had it, I was the oldest. So it just shows what a powerful show-off I must be. That, in spite of the fact that I had all the attention that I needed, this is not enough. I need people to print posters with me on them and pay money to listen to me for extended periods of time, or I will not feel validated.
I would say you're the definition of a benign show-off.
What does that mean?
It means that you're... I suppose what I'm saying is you show off, but not at the expense of others.
I hope so. I mean, I sort of feel it's interesting because it's about 10 years since I did any stand-up, and because other things have sort of got in the way, really.
Can I just say that's the most Chris Addison answer ever? Like, Emmys and other things have sort of got in the way, really.
Yeah, but they have. But it's interesting because, I've just turned 50, and you start to do... Whenever you turn a decade, there's a lot of kind of... assessing, isn't there? Mm. And I was looking back on my stand-up and thinking, God, I think I would probably do it differently now, and I'm sort of embarrassed by some aspects of how I used to talk to crowds, in certain circumstances, or certain people in crowds in particular circumstances.
Yeah.
I was very, very combative, and I think, and I sort of, and now, me now, I think I'd be maybe less worried about, less inclined to do that, because the insecurity that it showed, I think, isn't there in the same way, just because as you get older you tend to become less insecure, because you realise, well, I guess this is just me then, isn't it? I've got to learn to live with that. And
that's one of the best descriptions of ageing I've ever heard, is I guess this is just me.
Yeah.
Then.
But do you know, I wonder often whether there's any sense in, and this sounds so stupid, there's a huge culture of self-help and or going to therapy, or and finding a way into your personality and tinkering around with it, and I think that's a really useful thing for a lot of people to do. I kind of wish that I could do it, but I also think there is something in the fact that to an extent we need to learn to live with ourselves a little bit. It's balancing up those two things. I'm not saying don't go to therapy. Definitely go to therapy. Definitely do the self-help stuff. But there's only so much you can change about yourself, and you can either be depressed by that, or you just sort of have to find a way around it.
I have this expression which I always use about stuff, which is when, I don't know, let's say that thing that you had on Twitter with the angry people that were angry about you saying a dog was in a restaurant. So if you get any sort of issues with people on Twitter, or I always say I have a choice here as to whether I allow that to be woven onto the tapestry of my life.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant way of thinking about it. I think it's also, for me, that Twitter thing, or even how I would deal with audiences, it's like you don't have to win every fight. I mean, you do actually have to win the fight with the audience, because otherwise you're dead. But like, you don't have to get involved with this. And it, I hope I'm less inclined now on things like Twitter to respond to everything.
So
people are going to disagree with you, and that's okay. There's no way of changing it.
You've got to keep up with Chris. Come on,
Ray.
He's got lovely.
Have you thought about getting longer legs?
I'm going to edit that out, so it sounds like Chris is saying that to me. And everyone's like, oh, I really liked Chris Addison. I also, it was really nice to women. Imagine that's the trailer.
Oh, God, I've got to call the PR. Okay, deal with this.
Oh, look, that's an Airedale, isn't it? I think it is.
No.
Is that an Airedale? What kind of dog is that?
He's a rescue dog from Greece.
Oh, it's a rescue. He's a
Greek hand. Quite nervous.
Are you nervous? Do you want to meet Raymond? This is Raymond. Well, nice to meet you. What's your dog called?
Indy.
Indy. Lovely to meet you, Indy. Bye-bye, Indy.
Nice to meet you.
Bye.
Indiana was what we named the dog. That's what he says in the film.
Oh, look, that's a nice thing.
Oh,
all
yeah.
Right, what's that?
I'm going to say puppy.
Surprising.
What's that dog?
A Pattinson Terrier.
I love those Patterdales.
Raymond?
Yeah.
Well, listen to that. Hello, Raymond. I've heard you on the podcast often. Hello. Well, this is Nancy.
This is Nancy.
And she's 15 weeks old.
She looks like a kid's drawing of a dog.
That's what people used to say about her predecessor.
But
you know, if you kids...
It's like the Socratic ideal of a dog. That's what... It's amazing.
She's beautiful.
Nancy, yeah. It's lovely to meet you. Well, it's very nice to meet you as well.
Yes.
Come on, Ray.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Nice to meet you.
Oh. So
you don't get that with other cat people.
What?
Well, dog people greet dog people. You know, like bus drivers kind of flash the lights at each other. Dog people do that, don't they, when they cross? Dog people like dog people. But cat people, you wouldn't know, because you don't take your cat for a walk unless you're a lunatic. And there are a few of those. Who was this, saw a man in Lewisham, at the market in Lewisham, taking a stoat for a walk? There's so many questions.
Oh, I love it. Oh, so we were talking earlier about Junior Chris and a bit of a show off.
Oh, yeah.
Academic, good at school, worked hard.
I went to quite an academic school and was absolutely in the middle of that school. I didn't work terribly hard. No, I'm a deadlinesy type person.
Are you?
Yeah, and I'm inherently quite lazy. I sort of need fear as a motivator with work, I find.
Do you think that's true of a lot of creatives in some ways?
Yeah. I found it really, there's a great book by Russell T. Davies and Benjamin Cook, which is sort of a correspondence between the two of them whilst Russell T. Davies was writing the third series that he wrote of Doctor Who. And it's fascinating because you're just inside somebody's creative process. And he says in it, oh, I just can't, I know that I've got to do 12 pages in a day. That's what I've set myself to do. And I know that if I sit down now at this point in the morning, I can get them done in the day's moment, but I will not do that.
Yeah.
It'll be getting on for midnight and I'll go, ah. Oh. And I totally get that.
Were you popular, Chris, when you were a kid? What sort of team were you in? Do you know what I mean? Like at school?
Oh, I was in the music geek team. I was very much anti-jock. I wasn't nerd because I wasn't sciencey enough to be. I suppose I've always thought of nerds as a slightly sciencey thing. But I was, I used to hang out in the music block with other fey individuals.
You've got the sort of romantic poet vibe, don't you think?
I don't know. I mean, it was sort of like I sang a lot in choirs when I was a kid, and my squad had loads of them. And it was just sort of a handful of us who just basically gravitated there. And it was because the music block was aside from the main school building, so it was sort of like it's like a safe place to go.
And you got into stand-up a bit sort of relatively late in by today's terms, certainly.
Yeah, it seems to, isn't it? I was 23 when I started.
Yeah.
Which, in today's terms, seems very old and long in the tooth, doesn't it? But that's because everybody's got a camera now, you can start creating your own stuff whenever you want to start creating your own stuff. But back in those days, you couldn't do that. It was, your way in was, you couldn't. I mean, you could film your own stuff, but you'd have to buy a lot of very expensive equipment to do it, and there would be no way of distributing it. Mm. I mean, it's great, actually, because I do think, oh, it's so beautiful.
Explain what's happened, Chris.
So we've just, Raymond's just encountered a beautiful, what is this? What is
Whippet.
This beautiful grey
lovely
Whippet.
Dog.
Absolutely
what's it,
beautiful.
What's the Whippet called?
Bo.
Bo, I love the name Bo.
It's a fabulous colour.
It's not such a lovely name, Raymond.
Raymond, this is called Raymond.
Yeah, this is Raymond.
Raymond.
I think Bo's he likes Bo. Look at Bo's coat.
I know, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Does like Bo velvet. Have a raw diet?
She does, yeah.
That's the coat, I knew
is that.
Is that
right?
Yeah. Isn't that right? That's why the coat's so nice.
Yeah, raw mince with carrots and courgettes.
Okay.
Into it, and then sometimes you break an egg into it, sometimes you'll have a sardine.
You're basically making a steak tartare. That's what you're doing, aren't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah. She's got high
it's very, very fancy.
Yeah. It's Raymond D.
I mean, I'm embarrassed to say in front of my friend because I think he already thinks I might maybe indulge my dog.
I can't wait to
but
hear
I
this.
But I cook him. I get the blender.
There you go. I cook him. Mm-hmm.
He loves chicken. Mm. M&S char grilled chicken's his favourite.
I mean, come on, man. No cost of living crisis in Raymond's world, is there?
Looks like he's doing well.
Oh.
Come on, Raymond. Well, it's very lovely to meet you, and Bo. Bye-bye, Bo. If you were going to have a dog, Chris, what would you have, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. I've always loved labs. They're such... Yeah. But I think, actually, if I could be bothered to put the physical effort into it, I'd love to have a husky. But they need a lot of running out. There's a guy, he doesn't do it anymore, but there was a guy in Bromley who used to had four huskies, and you'd see him, he would fix them up, attach them to like a trolley, and they would take him around Bromley on a trolley like he was in the tundra, trying to get to the South Pole. Extraordinary. Oh. But sort of that's what they wanted to do, those dogs.
Yeah, yeah. Come on. So let's hurry up and get you famous.
Okay.
So you go to university,
mm-hmm.
and you did English, didn't you?
I did.
And you were going to be a director.
I wanted to be a theatre director, yeah. That was what I was big into that at the time. Yeah, I really wanted to do that. And then I didn't, because it's really hard. It's too hard. At school and at university, it's dead easy to do. You've just got a load of like-minded people who also have a ton of time on their hands, and you can just put plays on or whatever. But once you get out, it's not the same. It's harder to do. And so I ended up doing stand-up as a sort of pressure release, really. Just for something creative to do.
But that's so interesting to me, Chris, because a lot of stand-ups you speak to, they're sort of, you know, they say they're driven to it and they couldn't do anything else.
Yeah.
Whereas...
What they mean is they failed their exams. That's all that means. That's just... The man in the job centre said that to them, basically. Johnny Vegas told me a story once about... Because we started out around the same time, and Johnny was over in St Helens, and there was quite a big scene in Manchester in the mid-90s. And he used to do a night in St Helens, but he was signing on, I think, at the time. And he said he remember going in, and the guy going, "Have you had any work in the past 2 weeks?" And Johnny goes, "No, no work." And he said, and behind the guy, whilst he was asking all these questions, was a picture of Johnny doing a karate kick in sort of gold trimmed flares behind the dude's head. "No, nothing. Not me." He's an actual genius.
Yeah, that still interests me, though, that you approached stand-up, I guess, in a more pragmatic way.
I think it's sort of... I've always loved comedy. I've always been obsessed with comedy from when I was, kid onwards. I loved it. I used to watch... I can remember taping... You can still get this. Billy Connolly... An audience with Billy Connolly... which is taped in 1985. I taped it off the telly, and I just watched it over and over and over and over again. To this day, I still think it's the best hour of stand-up that you can find. And I loved all of that. I loved, and when I was growing up, the BBC Radio 4 used to repeat all of the classic radio comedy. So I would listen to Round the Horn and I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, and The Goons, and this, it was really big. In fact, The Goons, that was, I really came across The Goons when a classmate of mine lent me, his dad had some LPs of shows, a couple of Goon shows. And it was a proper kind of Road to Damascus type moment where I went, holy shit, I had no idea you could do that. I didn't know any of that was possible. And it completely, it rewired my brain in terms of what I was interested in comedy and so on. I can remember that going downstairs and watching Hello, Hello directly after listening to The Goons and going, well, this isn't funny. Whereas the week before I'd been going, that's the fallen Madonna with the big boobies. This is gold.
Yeah.
But the Goons just totally rewired my entire way of thinking. And then Python did again when I sort of discovered that.
But you didn't have anyone, you didn't grow up with a sort of showbiz connections or...
No, nothing like that, no.
You just thought, I'll give it a go. So did you start writing and book yourself a gig?
I booked a gig in the Frog and Bucket in Manchester, which is in those days was in a tiny wee pub on Newton Street that's no longer there. And I was living in Birmingham at the time. I'd graduated the year before, but I was hanging around doing temp work. I guess we go this way. So I was I went back home to Manchester for the Easter holidays, and I was in a pub, and there was a leaflet for Raw, a night at the Frog and Bucket on a Monday, which was an open mic night, and I was going to be there for Easter Monday, so I just thought, I'll go and do that. And it was horrific. It was a genuinely horrific experience.
Was it?
Oh yeah, man. So it was. I'd never been to a night like that, so I didn't really know what to expect. Turned up at Dawes, and of course no one's there at Dawes. So I was in this place on my own, nursing a pint because I didn't want to drink, nursing a pint for like ages, and then eventually the door opened, and some more people came through. But the more people were Caroline Hearn and her then husband Peter Hook out of New Order. And they came through, oh my God. And I did my 5 minutes to silence, but I can just remember looking over and seeing a table in the corner, seeing Peter Hook with his chin resting on his hand, looking at me going, fuck, who's this prick? Anyway, but I was very fortunate because lovely Dave Gorman was in that night. And he said, he came up to me afterwards and said, don't worry, this audience is shit, you've got some nice jokes there, you should do it again. And I don't think I would have done it again if that hadn't happened.
Oh, isn't that nice, Chris?
Yeah.
You never forget things like that.
No, you definitely don't. It was really, he was so super helpful.
And then, but you had the confidence to go back.
Look at this. So we're walking through a lot of leaf litter. I say we're walking through it. Ray is dragging it with him.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, and then you decided, right, I'm good at this. After, enough times of doing it.
Yeah. Trying to figure out if a bird just shat on me.
Let's have a look. I can't see anything.
Wait, then it probably
But you
didn't.
Know what? I can't see anything, but I've got wet wipes just in case.
No, it's fine. Don't worry.
Let me have another look.
No.
It all looks fine too. I think that was just a leaf or something.
A genuine, that'd be perfect, wouldn't it?
Can I just say, I've just touched Chris Addison's hair and it's beautifully soft.
Thanks. I made it myself.
Yeah, are you on a raw diet?
Yeah,
you want both?
Just because I can't be asked to cook. It's not a health thing. Heating bills are really expensive. We'll all be on a raw diet by October.
So you got the bug, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I mean, it's fantastic. It's brilliant. And it is, as a creative thing, it's one of the most pure things you can do. It's just you. Mm. You are in control of everything. Mm. You write the stuff and you perform. It's so sort of liberating. And if you put to one side the fact that most people are scared to death of the whole idea of it, it is just the easiest thing that you can do. Because all you do is rock up at a place and go, hi, I'll go on. And somebody else has sorted out everything else, haven't they? They've organised the night, they've booked the equipment.
I know you've said before, and I really like that you pointed out, people always emphasise how terrifying the concept of going on stage is. And you always say, but that's not the hard bit. The hard bit is the slog of writing it failing each time you sit down
to
write.
Yeah. The only way that you can put a show together. It's not like anything. You can write a novel on your own in a room and then come out and go, I've done it, guys. Like, that's fine. You can do that. But you can paint a painting, and you can do almost anything creative on your own, except to create a stand-up show, you have to think of some things, then go and show them to some people and have those people tell you, this is a terrible, what were you thinking? This is rubbish. You're a charlatan, go away. And you repeat that process until you've got enough things that they haven't reacted like that to. And so humiliation is baked into the process.
But where's your damage? Because I don't see any.
About humiliation? Where's my damage?
Yeah.
I think I'm... I think I'm just quite corn-fed. Do you know what I mean? I'm quite... I'm a free-range, corn-fed, our hens are happy kind of comic, you know. So I've not really ever had anything like that to mine, and I don't think it's necessarily a good thing not to have something like that to mine. You know, I think it can be useful creatively to have that kind of thing, although nobody really wants it because it's you know, it's a trauma. That's all trauma.
Yeah.
So I mean, I really think it's about showing off. I think that's basically what it boils down to.
Yeah.
Is it's
talking with
sustained.
Chris.
Wow. You can't take the whole park away with you, Ray.
So you ended up. Then your career really took off, and you obviously did brilliantly at Edinburgh, and that's where you were kind of launched, really, wasn't it? And
I guess.
You then started doing a lot of TV.
Yeah.
Mock the Week.
Yeah. I joined Mock directly after Frankie left. So I never went on it with Frankie, in fact. So the first time I ever did it was when they hadn't sort of found a replacement for him yet, and they were just sort of trying various people out, I suppose. But I mean, Mock the Week was a real kind of bear pit. You absolutely had to fight for attention in that. You had to, you know, because there's five other people, six, I suppose, if you include Dara, who are racing to get to the same joke as you often. I can remember once there was we would do these caption things, and the picture was of just a plane and the window, the porthole window in the plane, and it was of Abu al-Hamza, who was being deported, and caption this. And I absolutely knew that every single person around that table was going to try and say, I've had enough of these motherfucking shapes on this motherfucking plane, right? I knew that was going to happen. And it was just, and I got in, and I think about it all, not all the time, but I think about that when I think about Mock the Week. That, God, we all knew that that was the obvious joke. And you just had to, it was brutal. You absolutely had to fight for it. But I'll tell you how we knew that the atmosphere changed was, there's that bit, scenes we like to see. And it's 2 or 3 minutes of the edited show. In reality, it's 45 minutes. That section is 45 minutes of basically going and doing joke after joke after joke after joke. But there's no order in which you do it. So everybody's kind of fighting to get to the microphone. And you would have to, you know, you'd have to wait until somebody was just about to put their foot back, you know, up onto the ledge where you were standing. And then you had to go as quickly as you possibly could in order to get the next space. But over the course of my doing Mock, it changed. And there was, I can remember one time, everybody was just a lot nicer to each other and a lot more sort of polite about that. And I can remember one time, I think Hugh had done a joke and then gone back, and nobody went forwards because we're all going, please, after you. And Andy, I remember Andy laughing and going, maybe this has gone too far. but it was they were hard to do. It was a really hard show to do.
And then, interestingly, you were so well established as a comic, and then you decided to do acting. You got offered by, it was Armando Iannucci, who you'd worked with in radio, and or just over the years you guys have worked together, have you?
We'd done one thing together.
Yeah.
We were both on an episode of the News Quiz on Radio 4. And in those days, the News Quiz used to, the last show of the series, they would go away. Most of them would be done in the radio theatre or the drill hall, where most BBC radio shows were recorded. and then one would be away on the road. And we'd gone to Southsea near Portsmouth. It was me and him and Linda Smith and Alan Corran. So it was like I was in a car full of my heroes, and it was very, very overwhelming. Anyway, but at that point he was just doing a documentary. The BBC had this series, The Greatest British Sitcom or whatever,
yeah.
And he was making the case for Yes, Prime Minister, and it had got him thinking about a modern day version of it. And we talked about it over dinner afterwards, and I think, and he said, "Oh, you must come in and chat about that."
Were you really excited?
What I actually thought, I mean, Armando, I remember, you know, because I was such a big fan of Radio 4 comedy as a kid, I'd heard Arm's name a lot because, you know, he was a producer, and he also produced what I think is the funniest radio show that's ever been made on the hour, which became The Day Today on TV. I was obsessed with that show.
Yeah.
So I was just excited at the prospect of more time with Armando Iannucci, actually. That's what I was mainly thinking. I don't think I thought, oh, this could be it. This is the path.
But it really was the path.
As it turns out, yeah.
Did it change your life quite a lot in terms of suddenly, I presume, you were being recognised certainly in certain postcodes of London quite a lot?
Yeah. Well, there's like, when it first went out, and it was, you know, three episodes on BBC4, the thick of it, and there was if you were anywhere near Westminster, you would instantly be spotted. Anywhere else, no. It sort of gradually changed my life because it meant that I sort of expanded out from doing just stand-up and so on. I didn't think of it long before I did Mock the Week. So these things, you know, like Thick of It, the first series of Thick of It is 18.
Yes, it's because it ran for so long, though,
yeah.
Didn't it? Because it was it 2005 it started? No.
Yes, it started in because we had to wait till after the election for it to go out. Mm. So we'd already recorded it. We'd shot it in like January and March of January, February. Really quickly, really, really, so unbelievably quickly. Each episode took like 3 days. Which is insane. We had to wait until sort of the BBC didn't want to put it out until after the election in case they got in trouble. And then it did sort of, just a kind of world of possibilities opened up. Jamie Britton, who created Skins, I remember bumping into him.
Because you went Skins.
Yeah, and he went, I'll write your part if you like. And I went, great. Thank you. And then so he wrote me, you know, as the David Cameron-esque evil headmaster. And it was great. And that's, you know, that's all off the back of, I mean, the thick of it in all sorts of ways totally changed my life. And being in that gang changed my life.
And you being the polymath that you are, you then decided, actually, I want to do a bit of directing. In some ways, did Armando Iannucci kind of helped kickstart that in a way.
Yeah, because he totally did, yeah. So what happened was, The Thick of It is shot in this really unusual way. It's not actually that unusual anymore, but at the time it was shot in a way that was just not the standard way that you would make a TV programme. And so Arm had directed all of it.
Oh, I'd love to be on Arm terms. Can you make it happen? Come on.
Invite him on the podcast. Show him Raymond.
Yes.
That's what you must do.
Go on, Chris.
But he directed everything up to the final series. But the final series was shot in between the first season of Veep and the second season of Veep. It's madness. Now that I look back on it, it's pure lunacy to take it on. But take it on, they did. And he realised, well, look, I can't direct everything, but I need other people to direct it. But because it's shot in this unusual way, I need people from inside the family to do it. So he knew that I had wanted to be a theatre director. So he said, why don't you come and do an episode of this? And Tony Roach, the writer, did an episode, and Billy Sneddon, our editor, and Natalie Bailey, who'd previously been Arm's assistant. One of his amazing strengths, and I don't think it's sort of talked about, I don't think it's recognised a lot, but is he's really good at going, you come over here and try this. And he like he, yeah. if you present yourself as, I don't know, a stand-up to him, he goes, okay, but I'm not going to think about you in those terms. I'm going to think about what your potential is. And he, so he's fascinating. I really feel like there's a whole bunch of us who came through the Academy of Armando, because he basically taught us, like, so Simon Blackwell, who, you know, who I've worked with for 20 years now, he was one of the original Thick of It writers. But before he wrote on the Thick of It, he was writing in gag rooms for Have I Got News For You and the Kumars at number 42, all of those sorts of shows. He was a gag writer. And it's really hard for gag writers to get the jump into narrative comedy.
Yeah.
But Armando, being Armando, went, oh no, you're really interesting. Come over here and try this. And so, you know, so that's what Simon is now. He's an award-winning writer of narrative comedy, and that's Armando does that the whole time. So Natalie Bailey, his former assistant, who's now like a legit film director back in Australia, and Sean Gray, it was another of his assistants, who's now, you know, a big writer, and it's that's sort of what he did. And so I think he just went, I know you like the idea of directing theatre, so that's good enough to try this thing out.
Were you nervous though, Chris? When you the first day of Veep, you've got those headphones on. Did you get the North Face jacket to look the part?
I have a North Face jacket. I have got a North Face jacket.
I would have gone full North Face jacket.
Baseball cap. Veep. So I'd done an episode of Thick of It. That was the moment. Yeah. That was the moment where I can remember setting up the first shot of that, which was Roger Allam and Will Smith and Olivia Pulley walking down corridor. And talking with Nick, who was the DOP, the director of photography, about how we were going to do this thing, getting back to the monitors, which Armando was at the monitors as well, putting the headphones on, and waiting for the first assistant director to call. And I remember thinking, what am I doing? What possessed me to think that I, what the hell? What am I going to say to anybody? What am I going to? How do I do this? Yeah. And then he called action, and I can remember. Watching them coming down the corridor and thinking, oh no, that's not quite right, and being half out of my chair and going, okay, cut. And I went, I think I will know it when I see it. And as a starting point, that sort of worked. But yeah, and Veep was a whole other thing because it's Julie Louis-Dreyfus. You know, I've been knocking around with the Thick of It gang. I knew all those people. But to go over there and you know, what was at that point an established show already, man.
Did the power frighten you, or did you quite like it?
I don't think I noticed how powerful I potentially could be in that role for years. Mm-hmm. Like, it took me a long time until I made a film a few years ago, and it was when I was making that film that I suddenly went, wait a minute, what? We can do the thing that I want, because it's literally my job to say that's the thing we're going to do. And honestly, it was like, I'm so stupid, because it was a proper, wait, but people have to do what I... ask that. Oh, so we can do that. Why am I bending over backwards to try and accommodate the needs of whatever it was, presumably the studio, when actually I can just go, no, this is what we're going to do. And it took me a long time to realize that, because I'm not particularly interested in the power aspects of it. What I'm interested in is I like getting in and tinkering with the comedy. The reason that when I sat at the monitors that first time and did that first take, I suddenly went, no, I know what this is. It's the same thing. It was the same feeling that I get if I go to, say, the theatre, and I go, no, not like that. I've always had that. Oh, no, I want to get in and fix and fiddle. There's no doubt that I have ruined many a lovely evening of my wife's television viewing, pointing things out, you know? Like, there are people I should probably WhatsApp and go, fuck me. Right, but I'm quite a demonstrative person, so I find myself going, oh God. I think some of us do sit and think about things in those terms.
Oh, I know, the nightmares.
Oh God, yeah. But I also think that people who work in sort of, you know, broadly speaking,
creative industries.
In the creative industries, I suppose, as a whole, I think we are terrible for that kind of thing. But it's because we're interested in it.
Well, I wanna get on to your latest project.
Yes.
Because, was it 3 years ago Breeder started?
Yes. Three years ago. Two? This is season 3, so it must be 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Surely.
And what brought breeders into the world, it was essentially a dream that Martin Freeman had.
Right. We were sort of set up on a date, essentially, together, Martin and I.
Did you think, oh, he'd be quite a nice friend for me?
He's.
I do that with people. I look at people, I think, oh, they'd be a really nice good. Friend.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think you always want to, if you're going to get into something with somebody for an extended period of time, you definitely want to think we're going to get on. It'll be okay. If we think, oh no, this is not going to work, get out of that project because it's just going to be a nightmare. So we were set up because his agent had spoken to my agent about Martin had some idea. Anyway, and it turned out that the idea was that he had a dream where he was walking upstairs, his kids were upstairs and making an astonishing amount of unnecessary noise, and he was walking upstairs and saying to himself, you don't have to shout at them, knowing that he's going to shout at them, be better than this, be better, you don't have to do that, and then opening the door and just tearing them to pieces. And this was his dream, and he said it felt really real, and that he said, I think about the way that our kids make us angry. Like the truth about having children is that, as everybody says, oh, you'll never know a love like it. Definitely, you would kill for your children. Equally, nothing can make you angrier than your own kids. Nothing. They can be so infuriating. And those two things are very linked. And he observed that, in particularly in sitcom, you've never seen that. You don't see that. You see, you know, sitcom families are either kind of teenagers or wisecracky teenagers or something. But nothing that felt like a sort of nothing that felt sort of nuanced.
Yeah.
And actually, that dream that Martin had ended up being the opening scene of the first
show. And what I love is that you get to refer all the time to the dream that Martin had.
Yes.
And...
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the first Martin to have a dream. It's not the most important dream a Martin's ever had. But we do.
And I think the thing that struck me when I first saw it, because I have been a fan for some time.
Thanks.
And... I think, do you know, one of the things, it sounds like a simple thing, but it's actually, to me, it's not, because the swearing, the parents swearing, yeah. I just felt that was really honest and I really liked it. And I thought it was quite brave as well, because I suspect you felt you might encounter some controversy with that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because people tend to have quite a strong reaction to the show, one way or the other. And there are people who cannot watch it because of the swearing, and specifically the swearing at the children, which is all, you know, that's all very carefully managed. We don't actually swear at those children. We shoot it in such a way that we can make it look like that's happened. But people do really object to it. And I get that. I do get it.
Yeah, but I think it's so, like I said, I think it's very truthful. And those characters, the relationship that the parents, at Stacey Haggard, who's a brilliant actress, isn't she?
She's and so amazing.
Martin Freeman, and it was started, from what I gather, it was you and Simon and Martin would sort of sit and have these lunches.
Yeah.
And kind of swap stories, really.
Yeah.
About, you know, the kind of non-Disneyfied version of yeah. parenting.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. It's interesting because men don't really talk to other men about that stuff that often. And it was sort of like being at a support group. It was like we were in some sort of father support group. And we found ourselves telling each other things that were, you know, the darkest parts of our soul were bared. Mm. And it was sort of quite cathartic. And it's why we realised there's definitely something in this, because that's what the other reaction we always get to the show is people going, oh, thank God it's not just me. Mm. Thank you for saying those things, because I was going a bit mad here. Yeah. And actually, that's, you know, not that that's what we set out to do. I'm not suggesting we're all marvellous people and deserve knighthoods, but I think that that's where the truth comes from. And in those early meetings, we realised, oh, yeah, there's definitely legs in this. And when we've always... When we, when we started to make the show properly, after we'd done the pilot, when we started to do sort of 10 episode seasons of it, we would have writers' rooms, which we've always been very careful to make sure that half of the writers' room is women, because it's three white middle-aged men who've created this thing. It could very easily become an extremely boring show about another white dude's midlife crisis. But everybody in that room were to begin with, parents of children of different ages. And so we ended up, you know, over the weeks of the storylining writers' room, sharing a lot of really quite grim stuff with each other. And, you know, a lot of it has made it into the show. And I think that's why it sort of feels truthful.
So season three is about to start.
Yeah.
It's on Sky. It's already out in America, isn't it?
It's already out in America on FX and streaming now on Hulu in the States. Sky Now TV as well on the 13th. And I think I'm correct in saying all episodes will be available all at once.
Oh, I like that. I like to binge. Well, I watched all of them. I was lucky enough to be sent them all. And I watched them all. Because,
very impressive.
Yeah, it's
a lot. It's a lot to go through because
it's a roller coaster for me. Chris.
Yeah.
It was left on something of a cliffhanger at the end of season two because Martin Freeman's character Paul had moved out of the family home.
Yeah,
and that was another thing I really loved. Not that sounds like I'm saying I loved that he moved out of the family home, but what I liked is that he moved out of the family home because he was struggling in his relationship, not with his partner, but with his son.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting because that tells you quite a lot about how things are different now. Because back in our day, when we were growing up, the idea of a father, of a child having that much agency and that much of a voice in a domestic set up, and I thought that was so fascinating. It really got me thinking about how now that I can see that would happen, that if a father had anger issues and it was upsetting the kid, the mother would say, I think it's best that you move out.
Yeah, part of what we thought about to begin with is what a strange thing it is for parents now, but particularly for fathers, who in the space of a generation have had to basically do a complete gear change in terms of how they parent. The fathers of our generation were, you know, different. It was a different time. They were different people. Most of all of that stuff was left to the mother and still is, quite to be honest. But it's interesting that people like Paul have no specific role model. So his father is one of the characters, Jim, and Jim's, you know, just a very ordinary working class bloke who, you know, would worked for Watney's, would have gone to the pub of an evening, and, you know, and Paul's mum would have done all the work, basically. Mm. And it's an odd thing for men of our generation to go, we're having to slightly invent it. Do you like the mound, by the way?
I was just going to say, we've just come to the mound. I feel like, do you know that film Picnic at Hanging Rock?
Yes. Oh, it is very like that, isn't it?
Chris Addison has taken me to a mound.
The mound.
And do you know anything about the mound?
Don't come here on Midsummer. That's all I'm telling you. Particularly not if you're wearing all white. I like how he sort of widens out as he sits down.
Raymond. Do you know what, Chris? Do you know why I love him? Because he brings so much joy.
I love the way that the ears go up. Like, it's like... It's like his entire head expands because there's so much hair on it.
Come on, Rayway. It takes quite a lot of boldness and balls, in a way, to have the confidence to try different things. Because most of us get told at quite a young age...
Yeah, that we can't.
You do this, you have to specialise, you get boxed in.
Yeah.
And I think people who are outliers, who think, actually, I'll try this, I'll try that, that takes... You're facing a sort of external judgment in a way. What? Who are you to do that? Yeah. But I think it suggests someone who comes from quite a stable kind of home environment.
Right.
Because
that's interesting.
You've got a safety net there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? You don't feel.
Yeah.
You have to create your own.
Yeah. There's absolutely no question that the weird sort of patchwork career that I've been able to make for myself over the last quarter of a century. My agent said to me a couple of years ago, "You have the bizarrest career of anybody I've ever met, let alone managed." It's fucking ridiculous. All right. But there's no question in my mind that that is because I am immensely privileged. That's how I've been able to do that. Because I have a stable home, I had a stable home environment, that, you know, I'm from a nice middle-class family. I was never going to starve. Do you know what I mean? Like, so you can take the big swings because somebody has your back. If nobody has your back, it's fucking terrifying. Mm. They're the brave people. I'm not brave. I'm well set up. I'm the lucky dude.
You're resilient, is what I would say. Because you need to be resilient, don't you? Because every time you try anything new, you fail inevitably.
There's a lot of failure.
What are you like as a dad, Chris? I bet you're a nice dad, aren't you? Are you strict? Chris being strict?
Do you know what? I'm not massively strict. Mm. But I think I'm more inclined to be strict than my wife is, probably.
Are you? Are you the disciplinarian?
Well, yeah. Your kids are
a bit older now.
My son's just finished his GCSEs and my daughter's just sort of beginning hers next year and so on. So they're, you know, he's off into sixth form. She's in the middle of high school, so it's a different adventure now from how it was. But yeah, no, I think I was the one more likely to put my foot down. But there's not a lot of foot putting downing that's been going on.
I think you're quite a pushover.
Yeah, probably. Well, I think that's a real problem with parents is you can't be a pushover, because if you are, it's death. It's not death. That makes it terrible. But it's you will ruin your children. They definitely need the boundaries, definitely. And you sort of try not to do stuff because you don't want them to not like you. And sometimes they're going to have to not like you, and it's your job to put yourself in a place where that uncomfortable thing happens to you because it's for the greater good. It's easy for me to say this to you now here, but actually to put it into practice in the minute is really hard. You're doing two things at once. You are having to learn to trust them, and you're also having to teach them to break away from you. Like, your job as a parent is so weird, because your job is literally to make your children leave you, right? To take the thing that you love most in the world and equip it to leave you. That's your job. And so it's very hard to balance those things. We just, you know, I don't think my parents were on me.
Were they not?
No.
But not the doctor, I imagine the doctor had strict rules.
The doctor was at work. My dad was on call a lot of the time, when I was a kid. I did fuck up my A-levels a bit because I'm lazy.
He kept that out of the old honorary degree speech.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They don't need to know that. I didn't fuck them up badly, but I definitely didn't do what I could have done if I'd actually...
Yeah.
Put the effort in, but that is sort of the story of my life.
Well, it's not the story anymore. What I want to know is how are you, if we had an argument, how would that work? If you're upset with something I did or said, would you call me and say, "Em, I'm really upset about that," or would you just mull on it?
Oh, I'd mull on that.
Would you?
Yeah.
Would you just not reply to my text or something?
No, I'm so desperate to not fall out with anybody.
Are you?
Yeah. Yeah, I can't bear it when it feels like something has gone awry there. And that's not necessarily a good thing to have as a characteristic, particularly not in my job. But I can't bear the idea of somebody, you know, I can't bear the idea of somebody being cross with me, so I can be cross with... No, I can't.
Do you not like conflict?
No, I don't. Really, don't like conflict. I'm terrible at it.
How does that work as a director then? Because a lot of the conflict's built into the job, right?
Well, I don't think it has to be built into the job. I don't think any director needs to, like, that sort of the cliche of the director shouting at everybody, "Why the fuck is that there? Get that out of my sight! You're all fired!" And there are definitely those people, but I sort of understand why they're like that, because it's a highly pressured job. There's an awful lot riding on your shoulders. And it's, you know, and it's you, you're where the buck stops. So I get it, But you're not going to get anything good out of people that way, are you? Like, it's just not... If you treat people like that, they'll do their job, but not they're not going to go the extra mile or anything, and they're not having a nice time. And that infects the atmosphere, and that affects everything that's happening. So purely from a kind of totally selfish point of view, you shouldn't be like that. But just be nice. Make the atmosphere nice. It'll work better. It'll all work better.
What would Mrs. Addison say... What's the thing that drives her most mad about you, would you say?
Lack of communication. Failure to communicate. That's it. That's exactly what she would say. Write the thing down on the calendar. How is anybody supposed to know that you're doing the thing if you've not written it? Write the thing, explain where you're going. You know, just talk about everything. Let me understand where you are and why. I think that would be the thing that she would... But to be honest, it's the head of what I imagine is a reasonably large list.
I always ask people on this, Chris, what do you most wish people would say about you when you leave a room, and what do you most fear? So what do you most fear people would say about you when you walk out of a room?
Crikey, what an interesting question. Well, thank fuck for that, I suppose. last week we can get some real conversation going. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have an absolute paralysing need to be liked. Yeah, I also find the idea of... this seems so stupid. It's going to sound so stupid, particularly bearing in mind the job that I've had since 1997. But I'm always surprised that people are talking about me when I'm not there. I find it genuinely odd that anybody would, yeah, we were talking about you, were you? I still find it really peculiar.
And what, here, let's do the nice bit, Chris.
Okay.
What do you really hope people would say when Chris leaves the room?
What a great shirt.
Let's say last night you were with
Dara and Hugh and Michael McKean for dinner.
Yeah. Hugh Dennis, Dara Breen and Michael McKean.
Yeah.
Let's say you'd left first. What do you wish they would all say about you? Apart from nice shirt.
Yeah, I think maybe there'll never be another one of him. really like to see that guy again as soon as possible.
You know what I'd say about you? Ray picks up on people, and he's been really happy spending the time with you.
He's a little sweetie. I can't imagine him not liking anybody.
Well, we're standing here with a dog who looks like something out of Star Wars, and what I'm saying is, you're a Jedi.
All right.
You're a Jedi, but I'll tell you what else you are, Chris. You're a romantic poet meets physics teacher that everyone fancies.
Russell Howard used to call me the sexy lecturer. But that was many years ago.
Chris, I've loved our walk. How do you feel about Raymond?
I love Raymond. He's an absolute marvel. I've never seen a dog like him. I'm thrilled to have made his acquaintance.
Chris, I've loved having you. Say goodbye, Raymond. And everyone,
hi, Raymond.
Please watch season 3 of Breeders. And you need to catch up on, if you haven't already, caught up with season 1 and 2. I caught up with them on Now TV on Sky.
That's where they are.
They're
it's
so
streaming.
Brilliant. You will binge them.
I'm so pleased you liked it.
Oh, I love it. I didn't... Oh.
Oh, hello. Who's this?
This one's a bit fancy.
Very fancy. What's with the... Oh, is it?
It looks like some sort of poodle. Look at the tail.
I know. Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, Chris, we've loved today. Say goodbye.
Bye, Ray. It was lovely to meet you. You look after Emily, won't you?
Thank you, Chris. How does he speak, Chris?
I imagine it's sort of a bit like that. Yeah, all right. Yeah, we'll see what I can do. Yeah, I'm only little, but...
You can sound like Martin Freeman.
Oh, maybe that's what's happened. Maybe we've just become each other.
I really hope you enjoyed listening to that. And do remember to rate, review and subscribe on iTunes.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.